CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors today, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. The SAP Business by Design solution is a single integrated business management solution that delivers the best of SAP software on demand, offering the benefits of larger applications without the need for a costly IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association of CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, this month CFO Magazine had an article stated, "Are you reinvesting enough?" Capital expenditures, R&D, and maybe even acquisitions are keys to building total shareholder returns, the findings show. Those elements are not perhaps a surprise to us in the financial world. However, faced with substantial new desirable investment opportunities, a CFO of a client company of CFO Magazine recently chose not to cut her substantial share repurchase program to fund investments. Instead, she chose to finance the new outlay by slashing investments into other businesses, both of which were growing well and earning strong returns. She missed an opportunity to step up the rate at which the company reinvests in itself to drive its share price higher over time. Value is not created solely by maximizing returns on capital, but by balancing the pursuit of higher returns with an adequate emphasis on investment in future growth, says CFO Magazine. And please tune in to CFO.com to read more of that article. Well, today I'm excited to have Stephen Chestnut joining us today to discuss the role of the CFO. Steve, you are the CFO and Senior Vice President of Overstock.com, a $1 billion publicly traded retail company. Previously, you served in a variety of finance roles at Home Depot and also with one of the spin-off divisions, HD Supply, which then went on to be its own legal entity. And then previously, you'd held some analytical and operational roles at Target Stores. You received your accounting degree from Southern Utah University and an MBA from Brigham Young University. So welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you, Lorena. It's great to be on the show today.
Well, Steve, let's start at the beginning. What was your first paying job and how did you arrive at your current position? Maybe give us the journey of what happened in between.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. You know, mine is probably unique. I grew up with a family of, there were eight children, and so in order to put myself through college, I worked as an auto mechanic in a couple of shops. So, interesting, not probably the typical CFO route, but for me, it was a great paying job. It provided my ability to be married and to raise children while I was going through college, and did, as you mentioned, an undergraduate program there at Southern Utah University, and then went on to get an MBA at Brigham Young University, and with the emphasis in finance and strategic planning. Right as soon as I finished my MBA program, I jumped into the retail industry with Target Stores and moved the family from Utah up to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and spent 10 years there in the Minneapolis area working in many facets of Target Stores, from entering in as a financial analyst, being a manager, actually spent some time in an audit function looking more at on the operational side. And it was interesting at that time, total quality was the buzzword. That was back in the late 80s. And if you've been around total quality, that's also spun out to be Six Sigma, is kind of the latest spin on what emerged back in the 80s as total quality.
I remember that, the TQM, Total Quality Management.
Yeah, and that was a big, so the audit department there at Target, we took it upon ourselves that we were going to engineer total quality across the whole organization, and I was working in the audit area focused on the distribution centers, and that's what we deployed as a TQM process into a service-based organization. So very exciting time to be there at Target. Jumped from there, got to be a manager of store expense planning, corporate forecasting, and then for me, it was a great jump to go from being in a headquarters environment, and I took a position with Target out on the East Coast in Richmond, Virginia, where I got to be involved with taking a division that was, 100 stores to a couple of hundred stores over a 3-year period of time as we we grew the Target store base from Virginia going all the way up into to the Massachusetts-Vermont area. So it was an exciting time to be there at Target and to get heavily involved with the operations side of a great retail business.
And how large was Target at that time? I guess we're talking 20-some years ago.
Oh, there was probably, what were they, $20, $25 billion in size. So they have, when I left them, 13 years ago, it was a great organization and they continued to grow. So what I deem as a premier, especially in light of being in the marketplace where you got Walmart on one side, Kmart on the other side, and Target clearly carved out a great niche in the marketplace, especially relative to Walmart.
And dare I say it, but there are those of us that perhaps don't like shopping at Target, but do shop at Target.
That's right. Oh, you have spoken it oh so well. Yeah, and it was funny because during the years that I was there, we'd drive by a competitor store, and my kids would stick their tongues out at the competitors. But when we'd drive by a Target or a Target, it was moments of clapping. So the kids really liked it too.
Well, obviously you had a phenomenal start. What I'd like to do, Steve, is to expand a little bit upon your audit time frame. Very often the overview of your first role for you, which was in retail industry, can give you a very good feel as to giving you options for later in your career. And some CFOs that we have on the show come through the controllership function, others come through the FP&A function, and you certainly were on the analytical side. But you started in audit. Give us a little bit of a background of what audit taught you.
Yeah. Back then, again, this is for the audit piece that I was heavily involved with was the operational side. It wasn't the financial audit.
So was it going on roofs and making sure that the fire escapes were shut and all that sort of stuff?
It was really how do we get the operation to run even better, more efficient? So how do we carve out inefficiencies in processes and operations? So it was much more of the Six Sigma thinking, which is how do we take steps out? How do we make this process? How do we make it error-free in this process? Because at the end of the day, that distribution center of the store delivering a predictable experience and predicting, getting errors out of the way and missed shipments was absolutely key to running that operating model. So we spent a lot of time almost from a Six Sigma lean perspective of how do we drive efficiencies into the operations.
And were there any particular lessons learned in terms of the lean manufacturing side of it?
Well, I think the thing that we did very well for that group is we said, as an audit group, you can only be there once a year. So we gave them the ability to say, here, we're gonna orchestrate information, and we're gonna push information your way so that you can self-monitor what's going on. And we're gonna teach you how to do random sampling. We're gonna teach you how to do statistical sampling, so that when we leave, you're armed with the information and the tools to take and measure and monitor your own processes, which was real powerful because once they had the information, they knew where the defects or the errors were in their process, they started to organize teams to take and work on those issues.
So very consultative.
Pardon me?
Very consultative approach.
Absolutely. So it wasn't a gotcha group. It was very much a teach, instruct, and consult.
One of the things that many of our guests on the radio show have mentioned is that the opportunity for the audit function the audit function gave them was the ability to interact with executive management at a very young age and to learn from perhaps mentors from afar and quite frankly excellent leadership styles as well as maybe some not so excellent leadership styles. Was that something that you found you picked up along the way?
Yeah, clearly within the audit because we got to interface with the president of the company. And then when I left the audit function, and moved over into, the FP&A side or out into the field position, I was a known entity because I had interacted with key leaders in the organization.
So let's talk a little bit about that. You jump from audit to analytical. Both roles, with you saying that it was operational efficiency, have an element of analytics, but now you're jumping into hardcore analytics. What was your first role? Was it analyzing particular deals the company was looking to make or particular pricing or contracts? What was it?
Yeah, it was around store expense management. So this is the team that did, you know, the five-year goaling, the one-year goals for the stores organization, building the operating plans for the store, interfacing with store management to figure out how do we drive efficiencies into the store expense structure. And during that time, we pulled a full point of expense structure out of that organization while still trying to maintain a very high-level standard around customer service.
That's fabulous. 1%'s huge.
So it was, and that was a one full point. So it was just taking it down by 1%, but one full point out of the expense structure.
Wow.
So I jumped from store expense planning and moved over into a capital management group, which is the group that dealt with, if we're going to spend big capital dollars, what's the financial justification for doing the project, which included some M&A type work.
Did you get involved in any M&A lookup acquisitions or any kind of NPV analytics
at
that point?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we did IR NPV type work in that analytics group. And actually, we did one deal during that time where we bought the Gold Circle chain down in your neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you've been in Atlanta for many years, Gold Circle was one of the chains, the discount chains that was down there. And Target stores back in the late 80s bought that chain.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we found, again, from guests on the radio show is that the experience of going through that deal-making, particularly early on in your career, gives you a very good strength of a significant element of what is the finance and accounting field of it's not black and white at all.
Oh, yeah. And it also, I think, focuses you and says, you know, what drives the value in the deal? You know, and in as you cut the deal, you say, you know, here are the things that we got to do very well in order to be able to pay back on the deal that we just made.
Now, did you find at that time that the expectations were met post-merger?
You know, on that one, I think the answer is clearly yes, because for Target, that was a platform play to be able to get into that market. And then if you've been down in that Atlanta area, Target quickly started to build out and fill in that marketplace. So it was clearly a market that Target wanted to get into. It made a lot of sense. It was a growing market, good demographics for a Target customer, and then quickly followed on with additional fill-in stores to be able to continue to take on that market.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now you're looking at expense side. You've looked at the capital management side. Let's kind of take a more broad view, if we can, in terms of some of the experiences that you've had. And quite honestly, I would say some of the larger retail stores that are in the U.S., some of which have quite an international focus. Step back, if you would, and give the readers that perhaps are not familiar with the retail industry a little bit of an understanding of what the complexities are.
Yeah, I think when I look at this type of retail, because I've been kind of in the home improvement space and then general merchandise with Target, home improvement was with Home Depot, and now with Overstock.com being in the internet retail space. I think one of the unique things around retail is that you know, the customer's last experience with you can be a predictor of if they'll return to shop with you again. So trying to drive loyalty with that customer is absolutely key. And I think the consumer of today versus the consumer of 25 years ago is very different in that the loyalty that perhaps was there 25 years ago is not there. And so having a great experience every time has to be there in order to be able to get the consumer to come back to you again and again and again. From an operations standpoint, you know, this is millions of transactions that take place because the average order size or the average cart can be $100, $200 in size. So there's lots, you've got to have many, many consumers come to you, whether in the form of the internet or the form of a brick and mortar store, in order to be able to create the business model that's sustainable, which means the systems and the operations side have to be able to handle millions of transactions flowing through. I think the other thing that's absolutely key is that the customer experience has to be predictable, whether it's the in-store experience, the shopping experience, the internet experience, to how the order is fulfilled. And oftentimes when a service failure happens or an item is returned, taking care of that customer so that they feel good about their experience, even when there's been a service failure, is absolutely key. So those are some of the characteristics of retail that I think is unique and different than, per se, manufacturing.
And interestingly enough, the companies that you've been with, certainly Target and Home Depot, I don't want to speak about your current company for purposes of confidentiality maybe, but if we look back to some of those, they were very key into early in the customer relationship, the ability to have customer returns. And while many in the retail industry thought that the opportunity for that was really one where you were putting yourself in a position of declining sales, essentially it creates that additional loyalty with the customer. It gets the customer back in the store. And, most customers, once they're in the store, they've got something else that they want to purchase.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's amazing with the consumer of today, if there's a service failure or there's something that didn't go quite right, if the person who is taking care of that situation understands the very valuable role that they play, they can create an emotional connection with that consumer that can never be matched. It's amazing the number of notes that you get or emails that you get that says, so-and-so in customer service did this for me. I am now a customer for life with you guys. And when you read those stories, you go, you know, there's great value in that customer service and returns area that I don't think a lot of people understand.
And something that I would like to draw upon that is very unique for some areas within the retail sector, and perhaps my question to you is, at Home Depot and at Target, was this relevant? I certainly know that it is within the food retail industry. Very often when a customer purchases something, that is a sale to the company. At the point of sale at the register, when that is rung up as a sale, many of the items that are available for sale haven't yet actually been purchased or become the ownership of the company, Target or Home Depot. It's not until that sale takes place that that transaction of sale triggers the exact purchase. Talk us through a little bit of that and how that impacts the financial aspect of what you do.
Yep. So let me put that in the arena. We call it the cash conversion cycle, which is how long does it take? You know, if you've got a dollar and you're going to invest it in inventory, how long does it take for you to get it back into the bank in the form of cash? And some retailers, as part of their assortment, will do what's known as consignment, which is the goods are on the shelf, but it's still owned by the manufacturer. Another way of doing that is the goods are contained in your warehouse, but you've been able to push the dating out 60, 90 days so that, in that case, you're selling the goods to the consumer before you have to pay for those goods to the manufacturer. All of that speaks to managing the cash and how fast you'll be able to get the cash back in into the business, which is really a key driver for working capital management.
And in that cash conversion cycle, Steve, who is the party that determines which of those alternatives it is? Is it the provider of the manufactured good, or is it the weight of the purchaser versus the seller? Or who determines that?
Well, if you look at both the retailer and you look at the manufacturer, it's going to play, the economics are going to play, you want it to play so that it's in favor of both groups. So sometimes if you've got a high commodity item and the manufacturer says, hey, I want to keep my production going, but I don't want to have to have lots of warehousing space, they come to the retailer and say, hey, let me push these goods out into the retail store and let you, quote, in essence, short-term warehouse this stuff for me so I can keep the manufacturing lines going.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get the economics playing for both sides. Sometimes it's the advantage of the retailer that says, hey, you know, shelf capacity will only hold, you know, very few hours of supply, i.e. especially with things like diapers and that. So having a continuous flow of goods coming into the store is absolute paramount in order to be able to keep the shelf stocked.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a multitude of reasons of why somebody would want to play the consignment game. More often than consignment, around working capital and cash management is around what's the dating on the invoice. And if you can get the dating right, you can actually turn the inventory fast enough so that you're selling it before you actually have to pay for it.
Perfect cash cycle.
Oh, it's perfect. Yeah, if you can get into a negative working capital cycle, those are the businesses that you love, because then growth is never inhibited by funding working capital.
Love that. And with the advent of the credit card, perhaps in our more formative years, that does give you the capability to do that, albeit some complexities of account recons and credit card recons and such.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So within the current business that I'm operating in, we're constantly looking at how do I get another day out of that cash conversion cycle. And so to the point that we just looked at our credit card processing cash flows, and we figured out how to take probably a full day out of that cycle. So it's one day at a time when you start working through a cash conversion cycle. And at the end of the day, cash is king.
Absolutely. And would you say that Six Sigma is going on towards something else, or is it still the base rules of what was TQM and now Six Sigma?
Oh, I think it's still all fundamentally the same, which is it's all about process engineering. It's all about how do you take steps out of a process? How do you lean the process out? All that is absolutely applicable to a cash conversion cycle.
Well, let's talk a little bit about one of the processes that most CFOs frown upon, or at least did when it came out, that being Sarbanes-Oxley and the SOX compliance. Certainly there has been a rash of audit firms certainly being on the revenue generation side of making sure that companies were SOX compliant. And the CFOs have been on the, you know, my head's in my hands right now. I've got to do all this new work, and who's to say that it's actually going to implement or improve my internal controls? Now that we're multiple years into this, and certainly with Overstock.com having grown substantially, has SOX work now for you become routine, or is it still something where you're looking under the covers, new areas to investigate and so forth?
Well, I think it's two fronts. One is I think we've matured as a business, and now we've got a great group. We've got an internal audit group that runs our SOX program, and they've done a great job of making sure that the controls that are identified are the right ones. And because sometimes the tendency with SOX, too, is that you get so many controls that you lose control of the process. So we've got a great group that has really honed us in on making sure that we're looking at the right things and testing for the right controls. I think the other thing that we've done is that we've gone with the big four accounting firms, and that's who does our SOX validation work. So the combination of both of those, I think we've got SOX keeping an eye on the business and making sure that we've got the right controls in place and that we're executing on the right controls.
And obviously at the end of the year, there is a certification for you. One of the questions that I like to ask CFOs is, how well do you sleep at night the night you sign that?
Lorena, I always sleep well. But, ever since we've got a real solid internal audit department, and we've got one of the big four accounting firms, knowing that they have scrubbed us hard,
right,
I sleep much better.
That is good. That is good. And I'm somewhat joking with you.
Yeah. So it's funny because, when you look at audit fees, sometimes you view it as an expense. For me, I view it as the investment that helps validate that we've got the right things going on and that we're accounting for things right and we've got the right controls in place.
Your auditor's about to run down the hallway and give you a hug right now.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, let's talk about another component of the CFO's role. Many of the CFOs that we have as guests are now taking on the CIO function. And if they're not formally having the CIO report to them, systems and information is such a substantial role for the CFO and all of the people functionally within that reporting organization. My question to you, Steve, is how do you stay on top of the information needs of the company? Clearly, you're in a high cash business, you're in a high turnover business, and you're in a high customer loyalty / disloyalty. If the, you know, the products that you sell aren't what they want, they'll go in a heartbeat. So how do you stay on top of those information needs? And are there any specific technology tools that you use that you'd perhaps like to share with the listeners?
Yeah. Let me, first of all, I think there's a philosophy question that sits in the middle of what we just talked about. And that is, you know, the traditional U.S. business model was around a command and control type business model, which is all decisions are made at the top and then get pushed down. I think as we go into the future, the rate of change around business is occurring so fast that command and control type model will almost self-extinct itself. And so for me, the piece that has to play out is we got to figure out how to push information down into an organization, get it into the hands of the associate, the managers who are at times in the face of the consumer, talking with the consumer, making decisions about processes, how to shift, how to change, where to make investments. It's when information gets pushed down and people have the data that wise and intelligent decisions get made. So as I look at information technology, information management, that's the play for me is being able to push information and get it into the hands of people so that they have data and content in order to make decisions.
Interestingly enough, we recently, about 3 months ago, had a local president of the CFE Association, Certified Fraud Examiners, and as part of that, we did some research in terms of who typically in an organization finds out the fraud and potential misappropriations and so forth. And nowadays, with access to information not only readily being available to the perhaps junior analyst, but also the person in the company that may be inquisitive. I forget the actual statistics, but it was the vast majority of fraud and misaligned funds were actually found by people that were either new to the company or very young. And they tend to be the most intrigued. They want to get to the bottom of the detail, and they're not so tarnished with, oh, well, we've always done it that way. Let's just kind of move on. And systems are at the heart of that.
Absolutely. So that's, to me, that when I think about systems and information deployment, it is about getting it in. Even doesn't matter who the individual is, getting the information into their hands so that they can be effective in their decision process.
Now, with you being an internet-based organization, do you have specific investments surrounding those who might try and access your data inappropriately, the hacker out there?
Oh yeah, I mean we've got whole groups that think about how do you protect. I mean, if you think about it, we've got credit card information, we've got customer information. All of that is highly sensitive, so that we wrap lots of security around that data to protect it. Because if it ever were to get hacked, that's a death to an internet retailer.
Sure. What particular technology tools do you use? Not necessarily to go into details of what accounting software that you have, but are there any particular analytical tools or any particular view of you? Should a company have one aggregated, consolidated system? Is Excel still the drug of the day? What is your advice in terms of the systems?
I think it's a multitude of questions across that. Obviously, having an enterprise data warehouse is absolutely key, so that you say, I've got a place in order to be able to deposit and keep information. It's the right information. It's the correct information. I think is absolutely key in that architecture of information management. I think then the next phase on that is having the right tools to be able to push and deploy data out. And sometimes Excel is a great tool that we use a lot, but it's also a tool for the end user to take and manipulate and analyze and look at data. There's lots of tools that we've deployed that have more of a canned package look, where you give information to people and then let them click through data, draw conclusions, but it's more in a canned environment so that they're not having to download and then manipulate data into an Excel format, which can be very time-consuming.
Sure.
So we've tried to put some real strong middleware in there to be able to give people information in more of a canned format, but still allowing them flexibility to look at date ranges and click through to be able to see additional detail.
And do you have the age-old dilemma in terms of how you manipulate or maneuver, should I say, Manipulate has a bad connotation. How you maneuver the chart of accounts, what level of detail. I've certainly done some system conversions and implementations where we might have spent weeks debating what is the definition of a customer. And unless you know your main core elements of business, you're never going to implement a system that's going to be able to count it up.
Yeah. I mean, that's always the proverbial of how deep do you go into the into your chart of accounts to be able to count information and data. Yeah, but if we also balance that with we're providing a lot of operational data, not just accounting data, for people to use to make decisions, so that they've got both operational data and accounting data to look at information and help drive conclusions. Because I think you got to have both. If you have just accounting data, then sometimes you don't see the whole picture. And complementing that with strong operations data, you know, what's the consumer doing? What are they buying? What's the mix of the business? What's driving traffic? All of those key things help drive, I think, wise and valued decisions.
Sure. And in today's day and age where so much money's are going on social media, marketing programs, maybe even international programs if you're internet-based, your customer can very easily be a click away on a computer in Saudi Arabia as the click away in, you know, southern Utah.
Yeah, or they can be buying at 2 o'clock in the morning.
That's true.
You know, no longer are you confined by when the store is open.
Essentially, the store is open 24/7, right?
Yeah, absolutely. 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Wow. I guess that's the age-old joke with the Waffle House. Why does the Waffle House door, if it's open 365 days a year, even have a lock on the door?
Yeah, that's right.
Somewhat similar to Overstock.com, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Steve, the economy is still tough. We're coming out in the U.S. of what is a very lengthened and enduring bad time from an economy. The economy is still tough, and businesses are still facing challenges today. However, many of the companies that you've been with for your entire career have been growing during those tough economic times. What do you think is the CFO's key role in these circumstances? Because many of your peers may be facing a downward path, and you're one of the CFOs that really is perhaps going through the tough times of growing, and that profitability is and cash flow king is even more evident. It needs to be there in terms of when you're going through those challenges.
Yeah. So here's some of the things that I think about constantly. And Lorena, you mentioned one of those, and that is cash is king. I think as the CFO, you can never lose sight that is in fact the case. That whatever you do at the end of the day, money has to be in the bank account in order to be able to pay the bills and keep investing in the business. I think going along with that, and I've done this in a couple of other instances, and that's where you've got to get a profound understanding of what drives the profitability of the business and what customer segments drive the profitability of the business. Because not atypically, sometimes your large customers, per se, don't drive the profitability. It's oftentimes the small customers that drive the profitability. But understanding where the profit comes from and where the cash comes from is key, so that you know how to invest and where to help the organization emphasize. Because over time, business models grow up. They get lots of appendages to them. And it's the ability to know what's driving the profit and the profitability, so that you know where to focus the organization. At times, where to trim so that you shed parts of the business that are not producing the profit nor the cash. I think a couple of other things is, you know, at the end of the day, the winner in the game is the person who has the leanest expense structure. So I think as a CFO, constantly thinking about, you know, where's the expense, where's the inefficiencies, almost like a Lean or a Six Sigma perspective, but being able to drive out inefficiencies in an organization is absolutely key, so that at the end of the day, you start to create the lowest cost structure in your segment of the business, or your segment of that of the marketplace.
And would you say?
Go ahead.
Would you say that flexibility also plays a role in that? Because one of the things that we find is as a company goes from its emerging growth stage with very entrepreneurial leadership and rules and procedures and functions that need to have process behind them start coming into play. And then as you grow larger and larger, sometimes you become the Titanic that sees the iceberg, but you really can't maneuver out. Flexibility in terms of chasing that dollar, very often the sales staff will celebrate the sale, but the CFO really doesn't celebrate the sale till the cash is in the bank.
That's right. So you're talking about flexibility in a business model, and I think part of that goes too as, you know, as a leader in the organization, you have to stay attuned to where the marketplace is going too, so they don't get caught off guard, because you may develop a great business model that's relevant, you know, day one, but in day 5 years later, it's no longer relevant in the marketplace. So keeping your ear to what's the consumer saying, what's happening in the marketplace is absolutely key.
Now, many of our CFO guests have a B2B type business model, and they go meet with their customers, perhaps major customers that might be national relationships. For you, in all of the companies that you've worked, that customer is an end consumer, and as you say, $100, $200 purchase. So how do you keep in front of that consumer?
Yeah, so back in the Target Home Depot days, they used to do some customer intercepts. And there was lots of energy around consumer research that was going on to understand what's the broader trends in the marketplace around what's the consumer buying, what they're not buying, you know, what are key trends so that you stay abreast and design a concept or a retail concept that will stay relevant with the consumer. The fun part about the internet is that you can see, as the consumer comes to you, you don't physically see them, but you can see their click history, you understand what they're buying, how they're clicking around the internet and specifically on your website, so that you can see and get a sense of how is the consumer voting across specific categories. Which, if I wished at times on the retail, on the internet side, or excuse me, on the brick and mortar side, I had the information that I have on the internet side, because you get lots of additional information around what is the consumer doing and quote saying as they travel through your website.
Does that help you to predict certain factors?
Oh, and plus, you get real-time feedback about what's the consumer buying, not buying, which is absolutely key as you adjust assortments and adjust pricing and start to, you know, making sure you're staying relevant with the consumer. Because,
sure,
again, it's about that purchase experience is the strongest predictor about are they going to come back.
Sure. Well, in the model of leading the finance role, certainly the customer and consumer are key. They generate the revenue into the business. But another component of the leadership role of a CFO is that of managing the team, managing the organization. Are there any specific actions that you've learned through your leadership and your growth thereon that as a CFO that you take to motivate your staff under any particular conditions, whether those are conditions of challenge of growth or whether those are conditions of challenge of uncertain times? What kind of steps do you take as a CFO?
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, I acknowledged a long time ago that while I believe I'm a relatively smart individual, I don't know everything, and I can't expect myself to know everything. So, to me, building the team is one of the key and the primary focuses that I have as a CFO, as I think about the financial stewardship. And so, you know, whether it was at Home Depot, Target, or here at Overstock, building out a team that can accomplish the objective of the finance organization is paramount in making sure I've got the right people who have diverse skill sets and experiences is absolutely key. And one of the things that, you know, we use the word trust a lot with my team, and usually trust is built around, you know, the concept of, you know, telling the truth is the easy side, but also making sure that the team has, you know, the proper motives. Nothing is more upsetting than you get into kind of a hot political issue that has no strong bearing on driving the business forward. So making sure that the team has the proper motives. I think another one is making sure that team is competent and And the last piece of that is making sure that the team can deliver results. And oftentimes, as the leader, you got to sometimes make the tough call on an individual who, across those four dimensions, can't deliver, is not competent, good position, good person in the wrong job. So to me, building a team is absolutely key. Plus, the team members appreciate it when they know that they've got a competent team and peers that they're working with. Beyond that, I think it's being visible in the organization, making sure that you're touching real broad and wide, getting down into an accounts payable group. They know who you are, or a fraud group, so that they know who you are, so that you constantly can touch and reach and motivate the team. I think the last piece is empowering. Once you say, I trust this team, I know that they're going to make wise decisions, that are very collaborative, and then you say, let me go ahead and empower them to keep moving things along, because at the end of the day, the rate of change and speed at which decisions need to be made will only increase over time, so having that right team in place that you can trust is absolutely key and paramount.
Interestingly, Interestingly enough, many of the leaders that we meet on the show talk about having multiple smaller units that can be flexible and nimble individually and make quick decisions and good decisions based on small teams, but that multiple teams make sure that the entire function runs smoothly.
Yeah, I can see that. Absolutely. Because it is about speed of decisions, and making good, solid decisions is what moves things forward. Because in a command and control model, it's slow decision making. And I think the rate of change is occurring so quickly that those models no longer work.
Well, with all of those different challenges, what would you say is the number one greatest challenge to the CFO today? And obviously, you're looking at it from, for many CFOs, a $1 billion company that you help manage is massive. But for you, it's one of the smallest companies you've worked for. So what would you say is your greatest challenge for the CFO today?
Well, it's probably across a couple of dimensions. First of all, it's a people business, so it's about hiring and retaining and recruiting and training a high-quality workforce that you can believe and trust in. I think the second, because this is retail, it's staying connected to that consumer so that you know where they're going and what their thoughts are, what they value, and then as the CFO, emphasizing and make sure the investments are going to where value is created. And at the same time, acknowledging if you've got parts of the business that are no longer performing or no longer relevant with the consumer, being able to say, we need to trim. We need to cut those pieces out. We need to divest so that the model stays relevant and focused. So to me, those are the three things. It's all about people. It's all about the consumer. It's all about making sure that the business model stays relevant.
Sure. Well, Steve, I have very much enjoyed having you on the show today. I'm not going to let you go without answering our final question. Our tradition on the show is to ask our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? From the perspective of your role, what is your tip of the month?
Yeah, so I would say it's, you know, ask the hard question, ask the tough question about whether it's with people, the business model, because if you don't ask the hard question, you know the competition well.
That's a very good tip. And sure as anything, the competition's probably trying to look their best under your covers. Find out what you're doing, what you're asking, and what the answers are. Well, Steve, this has been an absolute pleasure. I'd like to thank you formally to Stephen Chestnut, our guest for today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thank you also to our contributor, CFO Magazine. And thanks also goes to our sponsors who make this program possible. Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information, go to www.sap.com/SME. And last but not least, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and finance executives. Their website is www.financialexecutivesinternational.com. www.financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know of one that would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.